I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. 38 years ago, Salman Rushdie, who had been working as an advertising copy editor, received the Booker Prize for his novel Midnight's Children. Less than a decade later, he was in hiding after his fourth novel, The Satanic Verses, was published, and Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini called for his assassination. Three decades and many books later, Salman Rushdie has a new one, Quixote, loosely based on Cervantes' classic story about Don Quixote. It's been shortlisted for a Booker Prize. In Rushdie's retelling, it's a story within a story. A second-rate author of spy thrillers, Sam Duchamp, creates a Quixote-like character named Ismail Smile. He's a retired pharmaceutical salesman and immigrant from India who is crazy in love with reality TV shows and a TV star named Salma R. Smile conjures up a son and sidekick named Sancho to travel across America and meet the woman of his dreams. As with previous Salman Rushdie novels, it's a heady mix of fantasy and reality, dark humor, and social commentary about our, quote, age of anything can happen, when the line between truth and lies became smudged. Salman Rushdie's been a guest on Radio Times a bunch of times, and it's great to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Always great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And what was your mood in writing this? And I say this, having read the book yesterday, I laughed. I was infuriated. I was anxious. I felt like all my emotions were tapped.
Good.
Success.
I hope
right.
That would happen.
What was your mood, though?
Well, I really wanted it to be funny. I mean, I thought in many ways the world that's being described is not funny, you know. But black comedy is a wonderful kind of healing thing. And I thought if I could make people laugh, then they might follow me along. You know, I think if you make people laugh, they'll go with you.
You also titled the book, and it took me a while. I mean, you do give readers
the pronunciation,
but for the people who haven't opened the book, they won't know how to say the name of your book.
Quixote, I mean, it's not that hard.
It's not that hard.
It's basically the French version. And it's really because there's an opera based on Don Quixote, which was done in the 19th century by Jules Massenet, which he called Don Quixote. And it's a kind of loose imitation of the original novel, and I thought since my novel is a loose imitation, he should name himself after the imitation, not after the original.
Kind of meta, right?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah.
Are you a fan of Cervantes' novel?
Yeah, I am, and I've got more and more a fan because since I first read it when I was still at college, the translation has got much better. You know, I mean, I can't read it in Spanish, sadly, you know, but when I first read it, the then standard Penguin Classics translation was kind of dull, sort of stodgy, you know, hard going. Now there's one or two new translations, but the Edith Grossman translation, I think, is really a brilliant translation and makes the book feel alive and contemporary and new, you know, so I kind of extra fell in love with it, thanks to Ms. Grossman.
It's been called the first modern novel. Do you see it that way?
Well, there are things about it that are very kind of almost shockingly modern. I mean, particularly in the second part, in book two of Don Quixote, the characters Quixote and Sancho become aware of the fact that they're in novels. They become aware of the fact that they're in more than one novel, and they have very strong opinions about the books they're in, which ones are awful and which ones are good. So, I mean, that's, you know, postmodernist metafiction in a book first published in 1605.
As a writer, does it often feel that way when you create characters, that they have a mind of their own?
Yeah. In fact, if they don't, I feel that there's something wrong. You know, and I think it makes me feel they're not fully imagined by me, you know, that once you've really imagined them properly, they start telling you things, you know, and there were things that happened in this book that the characters instructed me. I mean, I had absolutely no idea what could happen.
I hear novelists say that, and it sounds, I don't know how to think about that, where a character, I guess, takes over the novelist's imagination.
Well, what I think is that the way your mind works in the moment of writing, in the moment of creation, it doesn't work like that the rest of the time. You know, the act of creation really is a different way of using your mind. And you find yourself thinking thoughts, having ideas, so that you've never had in your life. You know, you put words into people's mouths that which are words you've never spoken or don't even agree with, you know, don't think. So I often think of writing as almost as an act of listening more than an act of making, you know, that you listen to your characters, see what they need today, and then try and give it to them.
Is that getting into a certain kind of mindset or a kind of a mindfulness?
It's just very deep concentration is what it is. And I mean, I think a lot of writers will say to you that you become unaware of the passage of time. You know, that I mean, I quite often think I've been writing for like an hour or two, and I look at my watch and I see that it's 6 hours.
Really?
Yeah. And I just had no idea of the fact that it's been that long.
So you've been in your imagination for hours.
And it seems time seems to pass quite quickly when you're doing that. And I think that's something I've got better at, actually. I think when I was younger, it was harder to maintain that level of concentration. I'd be more easily distracted. You know? Now I think I've actually got, it's a habit, you know, it's like anything else, it's a practice.
Do you need quiet to do that?
Yeah,
absolute quiet?
Yeah, I do. I mean, there are writers I know who listen to music and things. I can't do that.
Even TV and radio sometimes.
I can't do anything. Nothing.
Just quiet.
Shut the door and don't disturb me.
The last book you wrote, when you were actually a guest on Radio Times, and I think the last couple of books that you've written have been based in New York.
Yes.
This is a book that gets your characters, but also you out of Manhattan.
Yeah, I really wanted to do that. I mean, actually, while I was writing The Golden House, the last book, I was actually thinking about this book. And I was thinking that, you know, you have to leave town. You know, there's more to America than the 212 area code. You know?
Sort of like that New Yorker cartoon where, you know,
yes,
where America is the entire, or New York is the entire country.
Everything is New Yorker. There's a narrow little strip.
Tiny little strip.
Which is the rest of the country. So I thought, you know, I mean, I've been living here for 20 years now. And I mean, I've been a citizen for a number of years. I mean, I've traveled quite widely across the country. So I thought, I actually do know what it's like outside New York, and I've never used that. And so I was already thinking about some kind of a road novel, you know, while I was writing Golden House. I was beginning to sort of map that out. And then this strange coincidence happened, which is I was asked by somebody to write about Cervantes. Because like 4 years ago, 2015, I think was the 400th anniversary of both Cervantes and Shakespeare.
Oh, and so
they had the same birthday.
I missed that.
Yeah. And so somebody asked me to write a piece comparing and contrasting these two gigantic figures, you know. And I thought, well, I haven't read Don Quixote for a very long time, so I should read it again, you know. So then I picked it up and, as I say, plunged into it with more delight than I had before. And suddenly struck me that if I could come up with modern versions of these two fools, these two crazy old fools, well, one older than the other, they might be good eyes through which to see the present.
Well, I would love to have you read the very beginning of your new novel, Quixote.
This is chapter one. Quixote, an old man, falls in love, embarks on a quest, and becomes a father. There once lived, at a series of temporary addresses across the United States of America, a traveling man of Indian origin, advancing years, and retreating mental powers, who, on account of his love for mindless television, had spent far too much of his life in the yellow light of tawdry motel rooms, watching in excess of it, and had suffered a peculiar form of brain damage as a result. He devoured morning shows, daytime shows, late-night talk shows, soaps, situation comedies, Lifetime movies, hospital dramas, police series, vampire and zombie serials, the dramas of housewives from Atlanta, New Jersey, Beverly Hills, and New York, the romances and quarrels of hotel fortune princesses and self-styled shahs, the cavortings of individuals made famous by happy nudities, the 15 minutes of fame accorded to young persons with large social media followings on account of their plastic surgery acquisition of a third breast, or their post-rib removal figures that mimicked the impossible shape of the Mattel company's Barbie doll, or even more simply, their ability to catch giant carp in picturesque settings while wearing only the tiniest of string bikinis. As well as singing competitions, cooking competitions, competitions for business propositions, competitions for business apprenticeships, competitions between remote-controlled monster vehicles, fashion competitions, competitions for the affections of both bachelors and bachelorettes, baseball games, basketball games, football games, wrestling bouts, kickboxing bouts, extreme sports programming, and, of course, beauty contests. He did not watch hockey.
That is, first of all, I should say to our listeners, I believe that is one giant sentence there. But as you were reading that, I was thinking, boy, Salman Rushdie really did his homework.
I did. You know, and I think that we were saying just before the show that the thing about television now is that the best of it is very, very good indeed.
Right.
There's, I mean, the best filmmaking now, I think, really is on TV series.
I agree.
You know, some of the and the best acting, the meatiest roles for actors, and the worst of it is really, really, really awful. And you know, on page one of Don Quixote, Cervantes tells us that Don Quixote is mad, that he's literally had his brain rotted by consuming too much junk culture, the junk culture of that time being these appalling novels about knight errants and so on, damsels in distress. And I thought, well, if he was around today, what would his target be, you know? And I thought probably it would be, you know, this thing which we call reality television, which isn't reality television, which is unreality television, you know, which is highly massaged and manipulated and faked and presented to you as true. You know? And so I thought, it's not actually the kind of TV I watch for fun, but if my character is obsessed by it, then I have to get in there. Otherwise, I won't know what to put in his head.
But we're almost up in a regular, but you had to watch television in order to be able to write about it.
Yeah, I had to watch all these, you know,
all
these things, bachelorettes and bachelors and Kardashians and, you know, housewives of here and there. You know, I guess I could feel it rotting my brain.
Well, and so, I said to you, I would confess on the air when I've had enough of news, yeah. I do watch some Real Housewives, and I get about halfway through, and I feel kind of nauseous.
Enough, you know,
and I feel kind of dirty, actually.
I don't know which Housewives you like. I kind of
it's hard. Like is a funny word,
yes,
but yeah,
I kind of most enjoyed the Atlanta ones. They were sort of, I don't know, zanier and raunchier. You know, but yes, you're right. I mean, and you can't watch the whole thing. You can dip in. But I just wanted to know enough that I could credibly create a character who's obsessed by it. You know, it was something like fun, but it wasn't exactly fun.
Well, let's take that short break, and we'll get back to our guest. Salman Rushdie is our guest. He's been a guest on Radio Times for a number of his books. He's got a new one. It's called Quixote, inspired in many ways by Cervantes' classic novel, Don Quixote. He does take us on a wild ride through America. You can join our conversation, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Tell us about the reality shows you watch. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Salman Rushdie about his new novel called Quixote. It's about a number of things and features a second-rate author of spy thrillers, a guy named Sam Duchamp. He creates a Don Quixote-like character, a 70-something pharmaceutical salesman. He's retired and he's obsessed with reality television and an Oprah-like TV star. The Oprah-like TV star's name is Salma R. It doesn't take a genius to know that if we added an N, yeah, that would be you.
That's an extraordinary coincidence.
What were you thinking by doing that?
I was just having some fun. You know? But what I like about her, Salma, is that she is not the person that Quichotte thinks she is. You know, that he sees her on TV and she's like a goddess. You know, she's beautiful, she's famous, she's powerful, she's rich, she's young, all these things that he is not, you know. And he falls in love with that image, you know. But when we get to know her, we see that her life is actually much harder than that. Yeah. You know, that she's comes from a family in which both her mother and grandmother have had mental problems, and that she herself has a kind of bipolar condition, which has also led her to become dependent on opioids, the recreational use of opioids. And so actually, she's quite fragile and damaged, you know, and not at all this perfect being that he fantasizes about.
In fact, opioids plays a large role in this novel.
Yeah, well, he is an opioid salesman. He works for his cousin, who is a rich entrepreneur and a crook. And actually, oddly, in the novel, it becomes the way in which he can meet the object of his adoration, because, you know, because she's interested in acquiring these things for her own purposes. And so instead of, there's a certain point in the book in which the quest almost reverses, because instead of him looking for her, she's looking for him.
Yeah, you know, because she needs the drugs.
Because she needs the drugs. And I mean, I thought that if I'm going to write a book which is a journey across middle America, you know, that's where the opioid crisis is. I mean, it's not so much in the big cities. It's in these small places all over the place. And so it would be right to explore that.
Well, and as we know, opioids have really ravaged communities, families. Yeah. We now talk about these diseases of despair that are connected to people's addictions, whether yes. to opioids or alcohol or other drugs, jobs, joblessness, depression, suicide. Yes. We're even seeing life expectancy going down.
Yes, extraordinary. And the numbers are quite stunning. I mean, I think the numbers are rising up towards 70,000 people a year dying from opioid overdoses, you know, and yet it's until recently been almost invisible.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, one person in America dies of Ebola virus, and it's over every news channel network you can imagine. 70,000 people die from this, and it's hardly in the newspapers, you know. So I wanted to, I mean, I've been digging into it for quite a long time, and in fact, the story of the crooked Indian American entrepreneur who gets people to use these things
yeah.
by bribing doctors and so on. I mean, it's based on a true story. There was such a person who's gone to jail now, I'm happy to say, who was, I mean, he's not exactly the same as he is in the book, but the real person had a business, an operation outside Chicago somewhere, and was manufacturing a very powerful version of fentanyl.
Wow.
Fentanyl, you know, is the opioid that killed Prince, apart from anything else. And he was bribing doctors, you know, and got away with it for a long time until he didn't.
I read that you had a sister who died of a drug overdose. Was it opioid overdose?
Well, almost certainly, yes. I mean, it wasn't in America. She was living this is 12 years ago.
Yeah.
She was living in Karachi, Pakistan, and where, unfortunately, it's quite easy to get hold of prescription drugs without prescriptions.
Did the family know what she was doing?
I think none of us. I mean, I have three sisters, or had three sisters, and myself, and none of us really were aware of her deep dependency on these things, you know. And then you get a phone call in the middle of the night saying that your sister's dead, and she's young, you know, she was 49. And it was, you can imagine, it was deeply shocking.
I'm just trying to imagine having that phone call and not knowing
and
that
not
a
knowing.
Sibling, a sister,
was a drug addict, you know. Partly this is created by distance, you know, I'm now living over here, she's living over there, you know, that's one of the problems. And anyway, it made the thing personal to me, you know, and I started digging into it. Then I started finding out about, you know, the Sackler family and OxyContin and Johnson and Johnson and, you know, Dilaudid and Percocet and Vicodin and all these things. I knew some people in this country who. The thing that happens is that people think they can handle it, you know, and people say to you, oh, I've been doing this for so long, I know, I kind of know about it, you know, and then those are the people who die.
There was one, I think, a town in West Virginia of maybe 1,000 people where there were hundreds of thousands of prescriptions to this one particular town.
Exactly. I mean, these are really, the more you look into it, the more shocking it gets. And the thing actually that shocked me that I tried to write about is not so much that there are crooked entrepreneurs, you know. Gosh, what a surprise. Mm. You know, but how relatively easy it was to buy the cooperation of members of the medical profession. You know, that, I mean, the sums of money being offered, well, I mean, substantial, but they're not life-changing, like $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year, which is serious money,
sure.
But it doesn't buy you a Ferrari, you know, yeah. It doesn't buy you a house in the south of France. And it was...
It buys you numbness, though, right?
Yeah, but just the fact that people's integrity was so cheap. You know, that you would sell yourself out for not that much money.
Yeah.
You know, and so my view is that, okay, now it's good that these manufacturers are being pursued and there are these huge fines being levied against them. Good. You know, but I think we have to look at the medical profession too. You know?
This is an America that, quote, in the age of anything can happen. Mm-hmm. And on the one hand, you could say, yeah, great, you know. Sky's the limit. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's frightening.
It's frightening because suddenly the shape of the world seems to have broken. You know,
I'd love to have you read a section about that.
It was the age of anything can happen, he reminded himself. He had heard many people say that on TV. There were no rules anymore. And in the age of anything can happen, well, anything could happen. Old friends could become new enemies, and traditional enemies could be your new besties or even lovers. It was no longer possible to predict the weather or the likelihood of war or the outcome of elections. A woman might fall in love with a piglet, or a man start living with an owl. A beauty might fall asleep and, when kissed, wake up speaking a different language, and in that new language reveal a completely altered character. A flood might drown your city. A tornado might carry your home to a faraway land where, upon landing, it would squash a witch. Criminals could become kings, and kings be unmasked as criminals. A man might discover that the woman he lived with was his father's illegitimate child. A whole nation might jump off a cliff like swarming lemmings. Men who played presidents on TV could become presidents. The water might run out. A woman might bear a baby who was found to be a revenant god.
I think that captures just how I think many people, myself included, feel that we're living in a time of possibility, but of extreme anxiety and chaos and confusion.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the age of anything can happen is that it's a world without rules anymore. You know, suddenly we all have, I think, a kind of picture of the world that we live in. We think the world is like this. You know, and then we live in it. And if suddenly that picture breaks and the world isn't like that anymore, I mean, one description of that feeling is madness.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we all feel a little crazy. You know, now, the positive bit of it for Quichotte is in the age of anything can happen, maybe this beautiful woman on TV can fall for this crazy old coot.
like a man living with an owl, like, right?
Exactly, or a woman living with an owl. Interestingly, you know, in the West, the owl is seen as a bird of wisdom. In India and Pakistan, the owl is seen as a bird of foolishness.
Absolute opposite.
Opposite. If a mother calls a child, you silly owl, she's calling him stupid, foolish, you know, whereas here it's the opposite. Anyway, there we are, owls.
We're talking about owls with Salman Rushdie. But it's interesting. I mean, you grew up, you lived largely in England. I mean, it seems when you look around the world, countries are doing, I think, a version of what's happening in this country.
Yeah, I really think, I mean, one of the reasons why most of the book is in America, but there is a bit of it that's in London. And there's some of the backstory of the characters that's in India. And I wanted to say that this is not unique to America, you know, what's going on. I mean, we sit here and we see it every day and we assume this is our crisis, you know. But actually, versions of it are happening in all these the three countries that I've spent my life thinking about and caring about and writing about. You know, there's versions of it happening in all three. I mean, tomorrow is the British general election, which will probably determine the fate of the Brexit project. And in India, there's every day, it seems, new atrocities.
Against Muslims, right?
Yes. And I mean, India, I think, is actually beginning to not be a democracy. You know, it's beginning to become more and more and more authoritarian. You know?
Why? I mean, what do you think is the appeal, then, of authoritarianism? And is it sort of a counter to anything goes?
I think what it is related to what we were talking about before, that when the kind of the world becomes incomprehensible, you know, and metamorphic, and changing at an enormous speed all the time, people sometimes cling on to leaders, you know, the person who says, everybody else is lying to you, do what I say because I am the truth, you know, that becomes appealing. And in all these three countries, what's happening is that leaders are telling a fairy tale about the past in order to justify their actions in the present. You know, make America great again. When was that? You know, what was the date? Was it, you know, when there was slavery? Was it when before women had the vote? Was it before, during, or after the Vietnam War? Was it during the Civil Rights Movement or before that? I mean, the point about the Golden Age myth, that there was a time when everything was lovely, and if you follow me, we can get back there, is that it's always a myth. There is no Golden Age,
yeah.
You know? And the same thing's happening in England where, and it is really England, it's not Scotland or Ireland, you know? It is a little bit Wales, I'm afraid. But they're being told that there was this Golden Age of Englishness, you know, before all these inconvenient foreigners showed up.
People like you, right?
Yeah. And if you just get rid of them, but of course what that completely fails to notice is the fact that there was a thing called colonialism and that the British were exploiting the wealth of a large chunk of the planet. You know, and that's not mentioned. And in India, there's also now a desire to hark back thousands of years to a golden age of Hinduism before all these Muslims showed up. You know? And so in all three cases, it's the same thing. There's a fairy tale about the past being used to justify authoritarian acts in the present.
And that's our guest, Salman Rushdie. We're talking about his new book. It's called Quixote. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. So as a novelist, when the truth becomes a lie, when lies become the truth, how do you see your way through that as someone who lives in his imagination?
And makes things up for a living.
And makes things up for a living, exactly.
Can
I have the book, by the way? Pass it
it's,
over.
It's a thing that people, I think, people doing my job do wrestle with. But what I think, and there was a very good essay that Margaret Atwood wrote about this, which I'll just paraphrase. Basically, what she was arguing is that fiction is not the same thing as lies. You know, that's to say the purpose of lies is to obscure the truth. You know, the purpose of literature is to reveal the truth. It's to tell the truth about human nature, about what we are like as people, what we do to each other, how it is that we build the worlds we build, the communities we build, the societies we build. You know, and whatever techniques are used, whether they're realistic or surrealistic, that's just a technical question. The purpose of literature is to tell the truth about us to ourselves, you know, and we've always used literature in that way. People read books, and if the book speaks to them, they say, yes, this is how it is. This is how we are, you know. And so, in a way, I think literature may have an important role at this moment in which there is this breakdown in the idea of the truth. You know, that it may actually have a paradoxical role. People who make things up for a living might actually be able to counteract to some degree this flood of disinformation.
Your two characters end up in a town called Beautiful, Kansas, where a man comes in and he shoots up two Indian Americans at a bar.
Yeah.
I think kills one and wounds the other. And the characters in the story, in a sense, are sort of watching and trying to figure out how did this happen. And Sancho, the sidekick, says, is there a place for us in America? And I was reading that this is actually based on something that truly happened a place called Beautiful, Kansas.
Well, the Beautiful is not the actual name of the town. The name of the town was Olathe, but that's a Native American word meaning beautiful.
Oh, interesting.
So you
took something and made it.
Yes,
part
I didn't.
Of this
I didn't want to be completely limited by the news story. You know, I mean, there was an incident like that. I wanted to be able to fictionalize a little bit, so I changed it a little, but not very much. And actually what happened, that line of Sancho's that you quote, comes from an interview that I saw with the widow of the man who was killed, in which she talked very movingly about how they'd lived there for a long time, they'd raised their children there, they were members of the community, they felt that they belonged, you know, and then this appalling act of violence. And she said, now I have to. We have to think, is there a place for us here?
Have you thought that ever yourself?
No, I mean, I've been, you know, I mean, touch wood, I've been lucky. I haven't been the target of that kind of problem, of that kind of hostility. But it struck me very deeply, this what she said, and the line stayed with me, and therefore I gave it to the character in the book, you know, because, I mean, this is a book about immigrants, you know. It's a book, most of the major characters are Indian immigrants. I mean, Selma R. is an Indian immigrant, yeah. So is Quichotte, and so is the crooked doctor with the opioids, you know. So not all the immigrants are good, by the way, you know. But I'm an immigrant, you know, and so it's, again, like the opioid thing, it's kind of personal matter for me. And I wanted to look at that, you know.
We're almost up on a break. I saw that you referenced it after September 11th. A lot of immigrants said
it was different.
Felt that something was different.
Yeah, because I think, you know, anybody with a brown skin became the target of a certain kind of bigotry.
I remember on the New Jersey Turnpike or Route 1 in New Jersey, seeing often there were looks like Indian immigrants who had gas stations, and someone, I think, had a T-shirt on and said, "I'm Hindu."
Yes, people were doing that. You know, people driving taxi cabs in New York were putting stickers up saying, you know, "Don't blame me, I'm Sikh."
Let's take a short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Salman Rushdie about his new book. It's a novel called Quichotte, Quichotte. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Salman Rushdie about his new novel, Quichotte. And let me just pull together some of the things we've been talking about. His new novel is based in part on Cervantes' classic Don Quixote. It's set in America, a quote, in the age of anything can happen, when the line between truth and lies became smudged. It's about a second-rate author of spy thrillers. He creates this Don Quixote-like character, a 70-something pharmaceutical salesman obsessed with television, especially reality television, and a TV star, and he begins his quest to win her love with his imaginary son, Sancho, at his side. So he had to make up, he's crazy. Can we say he's, your character's nuts?
He's crazy, yeah.
Okay, he's crazy.
He's crazy and he's stupid.
Kind of like an owl, right?
I hope that he's also kind of lovable. You know? I mean, he's a lonely man. He's never married. He had no children. He goes from motel room to motel room with a bag of pills to push. And he's always wanted a child, and because he's crazy, he believes that it's possible to acquire a child by kind of magical means, you know, literally by wishing upon a star. So he does.
Well, you know, I was going to read this, but you're such a better reader than I am, so I'm going to toss this over where we meet Sancho, where I underline the other page, top of the page there.
Yeah. This is when, you know, he wishes upon the meteor shower and the teenage kid appears in the passenger seat of his Chevy Cruze. And he's overjoyed. And he soliloquy rhapsodizes about the arrival of his child. "Sancho," Quixote cried, "full of a happiness he didn't know how to express. My silly little Sancho, my big tall Sancho, my son, my sidekick, my squire, Hutch to my Starsky, Spock to my Kirk, Scully to my Mulder, BJ to my Hawkeye, Robin to my Batman, Peel to my Key, Stimpy to my Wren, Niles to my Frasier, Arya to my Hound, Peggy to my Don, Jesse to my Walter, Tubbs to my Crockett, I love you. Oh, my warrior Sancho, sent by Perseus to help me slay my Medusas and win my Salma's heart, here you are at last." "Cut it out, Dad," the imaginary young man rejoined. "What's in this for me?"
Oh, such an ungrateful son he is, right?
Well, he's a teenager.
He's a teenager, exactly.
He's born as a teenager.
But what was crazy, all those references, I got them. I knew what TV shows they were from.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, you see. It's become like a shared language, you know. I mean, once upon a time, like 100, 150 years ago, writers could use references to classical myth, to Greek and Roman myths, you know, and everybody would know what they were talking about. You know, if you talked about if you talked about Hercules or Perseus or Medusa, everybody would know immediately what the reference was. You know, now, of course, probably they wouldn't, you know, or many references would be missed. But references to things like television and successful films and songs, etc., people immediately understand. So, I mean, there's a character in the novel who has the nickname of the human trampoline.
Yeah, I was wondering about her. An old lover of his, right?
No, no, it's his sister.
Oh, it's, oh, goodness.
It's his sister. Sancho suspects it's an old lover when he first mentions it for her, but she turns out just to be his estranged sister. But, of course, the human trampoline is a line from a Paul Simon song. There's a girl in New York City who calls herself the human trampoline, you know, and that's where she is. They're going there. And I think that's quite helpful in the way that referring to classical myths was helpful to writers in the 18th and 19th centuries, because it was a kind of shorthand. You know, this is the shorthand we now have, you know, and so it tells people very quickly, you know, because they get it. It stops you having to write a paragraph. You can say a line.
This is also about siblings, about our Don Quixote character and his angry, conflicted relationship with his sister.
Yes, and his author, you know, because as you mentioned, there's this other storyline of the author who's writing him. And what becomes clear in the book is that that imaginary author is really working out issues of his own life through the fiction he's making up, you know. So he's very concerned about old age and mortality, you know, and so is his character. And he has a strange relationship with a sibling as well, and so does the character. He has a difficult relationship with a child, with son, and so does the character. And so I wanted to show how it is that real life gets transmuted into fiction, because the fiction isn't the same as the real life. And the stories don't work out the same way. You know, some stories work out better and some work out worse. But it just became a way of saying, this is what the imaginative act is like. You know, that you have something you begin with, which is your own experience. But by the time you've written it, it's another thing. You know, but the two things, in a way, illuminate each other.
And I do want to have you read that, but I just want to quote a couple of things. One you say about only children, you're right, but only children don't have, in the shadows of their souls, a deep wound where once there had been a younger sister's kiss, an older brother's safe embrace. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tough being an only child, you know, because of that, because there's no child context inside the home. You know,
we are on your own, really.
You're on your own.
Against your parent or parents.
And I think very often it's the case with only children that they get on with adults better than they get on with people their own age. You know, they have to learn how to deal with people their own age. You know, and whereas being around grown-ups is natural, because that's what there is at home all the time.
You also talk about time. You mentioned death. Time, you write, that lethal chamber of horrors whose walls close slowly in on the luckless inhabitants until they crush the life out of him. Well, I guess because I'm getting on, I circled that.
Yeah, well, you're not getting on as much as me. I think, you know, I mean, I'm 72 this year, and I think when you get up there, you know, you start thinking about the fact that the time ahead is less than the time behind you. Yeah. And so my characters are thinking about it too. I think one of the things for a writer that is beneficial about that realization is it becomes like an instruction not to waste your time. Yeah. You know, do what you have to do while there's time to do it. And as a result, what's happened is I seem to have written more books than usual lately. You know, I mean, that's to say, I've had four or five books coming out at two-year intervals, which is really quite not my normal thing up till then. You know, I mean, I've three times in my life taken 5 years to write a book, and once taken 4.5 years to write a book, and now they seem to have been sort of popping out every couple of years.
Do you feel like you have more to say, or just the writing comes easier?
I just think there's an imperative, which is get on with it, you know. And I think that leads the imagination to work. So I think it's helpful. I think sometimes this happens to writers, not very often, in a later part of their career where there's a sudden hot streak, you know. And I mean, the writer I'm thinking of is Philip Roth, who, in quite an advanced age, suddenly wrote the best books of his life. You know, he wrote, I mean, Sabbath Theater, American Pastoral, The Human Stain, I Married a Communist. I mean, wonderful books. You know, masterpiece after masterpiece, coming very quickly, one after the other, when he was really getting on, you know. Mm. And I think if you're lucky enough to hit one of those streaks, then you just ride it till it runs out. I think it might just have run out.
Well, time will tell, yeah. I guess. Salman Rushdie, our guest, I'm passing this book across the computer there to you. We're talking about his new novel, Quichotte, and you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We've covered a lot of territory during this hour. One more reading, and you had just referenced this about the writer in your novel, but obviously you're writing
I'm writing the writer.
You're writing the writer.
But this is a bit where the writer is thinking about the book, the Quichotte story that he's telling. You know? And he says Quichotte was somebody he had made up with a nod, okay, more than a nod, to the great Spaniard who had made him up first. Granted, his creation and he were approximately the same age. They had near identical old roots, uprooted roots, not only in the same city, but in the same neighborhood of that city. And their parents' lives paralleled each other, so much so that he, brother, on some days had difficulty remembering which history was his own and which Quichotte's. Their families often blurred together in his mind. And yet he insisted, no, he is not I. He is a thing I have made in order to tell the tale I want to tell.
Like Geppetto?
You know, the Sancho character is actually more like Pinocchio than Sancho Panza.
Oh.
You know, I mean, in the sense that he is a created child, you know, in the way that the woodcarver Geppetto carves a puppet and then the puppet wants to be a real live boy, you know. Sancho is brought into being by a kind of miracle.
Yeah.
But is the thing that he cares about most is being real, you know. And he's, in a way, he's more invested in the idea of humanity and reality than anyone else in the book, you know. And he is kind of, I mean, he even has a talking cricket.
You kind of threw the whole kitchen sink in.
The whole thing.
It
is like Picasso. This is like, you know, Quixote meets Pinocchio. No, the talking cricket, by the way, who obviously speaks Italian.
Of course.
Is because I was looking at, if one can imagine the impossible distance, the age before Walt Disney, you know, there was an Italian novel called Pinocchio. Written by Carlo Collodi, in which Pinocchio is visited by a talking cricket who is called Grillo Parlante, which means talking cricket. And so I thought, I'll have the original cricket, you know, no top hat, no umbrella, you know, but still, in a way, serving the role of conscience. You know? And in this case, towards a boy, teenage boy who was rather lacking in the conscious department.
Nowhere in this novel does the name Donald Trump appear, and yet I have a feeling that he's
lurking
somewhere in the background of your imagination.
Well, I mean, the trouble is he's lurking in the background of all our imaginations every day, you know. And for that reason, I thought I didn't want to talk about him, you know, because we talk about him too much already.
And you feel that?
Yeah, I just think he's there. He is every day. Every conversation ends in Trump, you know. And I thought this is really, I want to write about America, not about Trump. And because, as we were saying earlier, some of these problems that the country is looking at are, first of all, they existed before Trump, you know, and they will exist even if he were to evaporate tomorrow. And secondly, they're not unique to America. They're also versions of these things are happening elsewhere. So I'm interested in that. I'm interested in the world, not giving one person the credit for having invented the world we live in, because he didn't. You know, he's made it worse. I think he's very skilled at exploiting the wounds in the society, you know, but he didn't create them. You know? And even in this disbelief in the truth, you know, that predated him. You know, one of the consequences of the age of the internet was that people began to distrust mainstream media, and that on the internet you found valuable sites side by side with absolute garbage, and began to be difficult for people to distinguish between them. So the world is there, and he's a phenomenon in it. But I thought we have enough of that phenomenon already.
And that's Salman Rushdie, our guest. He's got a new book, a novel called Quixote. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, your character doesn't like hockey, but he does seem to like baseball, and you're a big Yankees fan.
Yes, I am. May be difficult to say that in Philadelphia.
Just this once.
Yeah, right. No, I mean,
why
I,
baseball
I,
though, or I, why well, Yankees?
I always, you know, like I mean, as I say, I've been living in New York for 20 years. So, but I've been coming to New York since I was in my mid twenties, you know, and I had friends who were big baseball fans, and you know, my friend Paul Auster is a big Mets fan, and Don DeLillo, of course, is a boy from the Bronx, and so grew up in the shadow of the stadium, etc. And so I had guides in both directions, and I just thought, first of all, I thought Shea Stadium is a toilet, you know, and who wants to go there? Yankee Stadium, the old one,
better.
I mean, still not fantastic, but better, and also, you know, the Yankees won more games.
You picked the winners,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I thought, why not? But, you know, the phenomenon of becoming a fan is not entirely rational. You know, you suddenly discover that there's one team whose results you're looking for, you know, and another one that you're not. So yeah, I mean, I really, one of my ways of unwinding when I'm writing is at the end of a day just to turn on the TV and watch the game, you know. And I always really feel bereft when it's not the baseball season, because I don't have that.
And do you say we're number one? I mean, do you so identify with the Yankees where you can use the we word?
I can indeed. Yes, I'm serious. I'm serious. I go as often as I can. And actually going to the game is an entirely different experience than watching it on television. And one of the things I really like about American sports is the way in which the audiences are both men and women, you know, and there's a lot of children there. If you go to a British soccer game, it's almost entirely men.
Oh, you know? Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And also, in a British soccer game, the opposing team's fans have to be segregated into a section, you know, in order to keep them safe. Whereas, you know, you go to a Yankees-Red Sox game, there are people wearing Red Sox outfits, you know, sitting right in the middle of the Yankee fans, and they get teased, you know, but it's not dangerous. You know, nobody's punching
anybody. Well, come to Philadelphia. I'll say you might change your experience there. Well, Salman Rushdie, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And again, he's got a new book, a novel. It's called Quixote. It's his 19th book, his 14th novel, and it is on the short list for the Booker Prize. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.